This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Heather Bell Adams wanted to have a little fun, so she sat down to write a novel. What, that's not your idea of a good time? Well, for Heather, it was a treat to let her memories of small-town North Carolina populate the pages and weave a tale of loss, hope, and redemption that reviewers are calling an ode to beauty and suffering, grief and hope in a small mountain town. Heather's going to read from her book, Maranatha Road, on September 10th at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro, and then she's going to be at Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville and Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh later in the month. Heather Bell Adams joins me today. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
It's good to have you here. Tell us about this, because you are you're a lawyer.
Yes.
Right? And you do a lot of lawyering, which presumably has to do with the truth, although crafting, crafting the tale is an important part of what you do. Well, how long have you been writing, and is that sort of what you do, daydream? Do you sit there in court thinking about your novel?
Sure. Well, for as long as I remember, my favorite hobbies have been reading and writing. So I started off writing short stories just as something fun to do. And I did have as an ultimate goal to write a novel. So one day I just got out my notebook and started brainstorming ideas for a novel. And I would say those are mostly character sketches. Mm-hmm. I think character is really important in a novel. So the idea for this particular book, Maranatha Road, which of course is my first novel, came to me as an image of a young girl who is in a rainstorm waiting for her parents to return. And that the story really just took off from there. And the image did remain in the story throughout the revision process. And it's actually the start of chapter one.
Did that image come to you while you were thinking about a story, or was it in the middle of nowhere?
It was really out of the blue. Wow. I just had this image of the young girl as a character and just kept asking myself, you know, what else might happen to her and where the story might go from there.
Would you read for us?
Sure. So this is the start of chapter one. This is from Tinley's perspective. If Mr. Hawtrey comes crawling down the driveway in his big gold Buick, it will mean they haven't found Mama and Daddy. It's dark in the old chicken shed, and nobody knows where I am. When I bend down, I can see through a hole in the wood, the fig tree, the gravel driveway, the road with fields on both sides, green and slippery in the rain. If I see my mother's little hatchback, then it's easy. Some of the roads could have been washed out, and they took a while to get back. Daddy will shake his head and say, "I'm awfully sorry everybody was worried. They were supposed to be back before supper yesterday, and now it's almost supper time a day later. But they're not back yet, and as far as I know, nobody has seen them. I should have gone with them. That way, whatever happened, we would be together."
Heather Bell Adams reading from her novel, Maranatha Road. She's going to be at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro on September 10th and other venues around the state later in the month. So tell us more about this story as it emerged. Give us some of the background.
Sure. Well, it's really a character-driven story. I think most good stories are driven by their characters. And in this story here, we have the perspective of Sadie, who is an older woman whose son dies shortly before his wedding. And then we have Tinley, who is a young stranger who shows up claiming she's pregnant with Mark's child.
It's her son, her lost son, right?
Right, exactly. And then we also hear directly from Mark, who is Sadie's son. And we also hear from Clive, who is Sadie's husband.
These characters are complex in the sense that, as we'll talk more about this, and Sadie is going to have a little bit of a hard time believing Tinley, right? And we may or may not identify with Tinley, but if we do and we like her, then we're having a hard time liking Sadie. What was going through your mind as you were painting these characters? Were you struggling with how we might receive them?
Yes, actually, I did have a hard time with Sadie at first because she's a little bit introverted, she's withdrawn, and certainly for much of the story, she's consumed by grief, so she's not in a good place. And I really just had fun with her character in terms of experimenting. I wrote her voice in different ways until I reached a way of writing Sadie that I felt like seemed true to her character, but also hopefully in a way that made the reader sympathize with her.
Did she come to you right away? After I'm watching you, I'm sort of imagining you with this image, now trying to pull it out a little bit. How quickly did Sadie emerge as someone who would be part of that story?
pretty quickly, I knew that there was an older woman whose son had gotten involved with Tinley in one way or another. And I knew that these two women at first were going to be at odds with each other, and that it was going to take the course of the story, really, to bring them together in the end.
How did you know when you saw this image, again, going back to that first flash for you, that it was, did you know right away it was a novel, or was this going to be another one of the stories that you'd been writing?
That's a good question. When I was doing that brainstorming, I was jotting down different ideas, different images or phrases that came to me, or different types of characters. And oftentimes it might just be a word or a phrase or a line. When I got to this image, I wrote several pages at once in the notebook. And so that's kind of what indicated to me that there was more of a story here to explore.
Can I ask you to read again?
Yes. I will read from the first time we encounter the older character of Sadie. So this is the beginning of chapter 3. The last time our son Mark and his fiancée Maddie came up to the house for Sunday dinner was in October, a couple months before they were supposed to get married. Maddie was the kind of girl everything is easy for, the way breathing is for the rest of us. When Mark met her, there wasn't any way of knowing how it would all turn out. But no matter what he did, he loved her. That was something he tried to tell me the last time I saw him. Mark had gotten a good job out of high school working with the logging company. He and a boy from work moved into one of the rental houses we owned, but he still stayed with us a couple times a week. When my husband Clive and I saw Mark coming down the driveway, we never knew how he'd be once he walked in the door. Sometimes he laughed at any little thing that happened, the kind of laugh somebody across the room would notice. And other days, he moved slowly, like he was underwater. The way I see it, people will do just about anything they can for their children. But when Mark got like that, there was nothing Clive or I could do to pull him up. He would look way off in the distance, like he could see where it was all going. Only there was no way to go someplace different, because he was stuck.
Heather Adams reading from her debut novel, Maranatha Road. She'll be at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro on September 10th. We've got a list of her readings at our website, stateofthings.org. As this book comes together, it seems to me, and you've said this, one of the things, and it's obvious from reading it, that one of the themes is grief. And one of the things that struck me is how grief plays with memory. And if you've lost someone, those memories almost need to be locked in place in order for you to have that person, anything left of them. And therefore, someone who comes in, a stranger, who threatens to overturn the only thing left is a real threat to everything, to your own identity, isn't it?
Yes, I think that's very perceptive. And that definitely is at play between the characters of Sadie and Tinley. And Sadie is threatened by Tinley because she does present a different view of her son than what Sadie had in her mind to begin with.
Is this a theme that was interesting to you? Again, I keep thinking of you sort of being flashed, kind of bowled over with this image. Are these themes of grief and recollection and identity also important to you and things you've wanted to get into a novel?
Yes, I would say in part because I lost my mother when I was in high school. So certainly when I was younger, I went through a time of grief myself. I think the overarching theme of the book, though, it turns out to be one of redemption or hope. I like the idea that even as these characters are struck with tragedy or they're in a dark place, as the story progresses and throughout their journey, some light does begin to pierce through that darkness.
If we let grief do its work, it should lead us to redemption and hope. Sometimes when we block grief and we just don't like the sheer pain of it, and who could be blamed for wanting grief, not wanting grief, it's not allowed to come to fruition. These stories, and it's also set in the mountains. I mean, this is an Appalachian tale. Is the setting important to you? Is that something that you knew you had to get in your book, or was simply a part of this book?
Sure. Well, I'm from Hendersonville, and I grew up there. My grandparents and great-grandparents are from Tuxedo, Zirconia, Green River area. And I like that idea as a setting for the book. I did choose a fictional town in the book named Garnet, but it incorporates memories I have of the area. And what strikes me most, I would say, about that area is the sense of community and the way that people look out for one another.
I mean, that can be good and bad. The good thing is they've got your back and they look out for one another. The bad thing is a little gossipy.
Yes, and gossip definitely plays a role in the book. I wanted to have a little bit of fun with that. And what I mean is the characters in the book worry about gossip. They worry, what would people think if they knew what I was up to, if they knew my secret? But as the story progresses, the role gossip plays is actually a helpful one rather than a harmful one. And I think that harkens back to the sense of community and the idea that people look out for one another.
How do Sadie and Tinley come together?
Well, it takes a lot of time for them to come together, and I think it takes a lot of personal growth individually for them to be in a place that they're able to come together.
Can I ask you to read for us again?
Yes. We have, this is when we meet Mark Caswell, Sadie's son. This is a scene from his perspective. The second time I do wrong by Maddie, it's late afternoon, and I have dirt caked under my fingernails and sawdust mixed with sweat in my hair. But Maddie has never been a bit bothered by me showing up after work, and this girl isn't either. Both of them are good through and through. Maddie, who I set to marry in December, and this girl, who needs me. After what happened last time, I shouldn't have come back here. I should have found Tinley somewhere else to stay. We could have gone our separate ways. But she's impossible to let go of. Lord, this girl, the sweetness in her, even with what she's been through, and curves everywhere you look. I start sweating whenever I think about her. Right now, her hair is pulled back from her face, and her legs are twisted up with mine in her bed. She reached for me this second time like she was drowning, and I was air and dry land both. Tinley needs me like nobody else does.
That is Heather Bell. Heather Bell. I was going to stop you at Heather Bell, but you're not.
Right,
you're actually Heather Bell Adams. There's more to you than just that.
Right.
Your debut novel is Maranatha Road. So you're a lawyer and been writing, but writing has been important. You said you've loved writing and reading. Have you always aspired to write?
Yes, I have always aspired to write. It's interesting because as a lawyer, I get to write as well, but I'm constrained by, of course, the factual record and the relevant case law. So there's a freedom when it comes to writing fiction because I don't have those constraints and I can just make it up as I go along.
Though there's a lot of story. I mean, at least for trial lawyers, storytelling is an important part of the job, right?
That's exactly right. You're trying to craft a story to persuade the court to rule in your client's favor and use the facts and the case law in order to do that.
So does any of that training carry over to writing, or do you have to block that out in order to write?
That's a good question. I think they're pretty different types of writing, but certainly with both, you would have an attention to detail and just kind of a focus that you bring to the work.
And you've been writing short stories. This is your first novel. Categorically different for you? I've talked to a number of writers, and some say it's more or less the same thing, just more of it, and others say, you know, categorical different form.
Well, I definitely think it's more challenging to write a novel just because you have to stick with it longer. And I went into it thinking I'll just have fun with this and see what happens. And certainly I had times where I was discouraged and I thought, well, this is crazy. I don't know what I was thinking that I could do this. And what was key for me during those times was the support of my husband, Jeff, our son, Davis, friends of mine who would encourage me or just let me vent to them and, you know, we'll get through it.
Get through. What about the, again, starting from a single image and threading out an entire novel? Many surprises. There had to be a number of surprises for you along the way, right?
There were. I don't want to give anything away, but what happens with Sadie's husband, Clive, was a surprise to me. But it was one that just seemed inevitable as I wrote the story and as it developed.
Also, I wonder about alternatives, because it seems to me that starting with a simple image, a complex image in the sense of sort of all the questions that it raised, leaves the possibility of other stories. Did you have other threads that led to cul-de-sacs and dead ends when you're trying to tell the story of a girl in the rain waiting for her parents?
Right. At times I did, and I played around with people's ages a little bit, and I played around with the chronology of the story. Again, just kind of having fun with it and seeing what made sense and what had kind of an emotional resonance. So there were stops and starts. There were pages that I had to discard because they ended up just not working with the story ultimately.
Did it ever upend the entire – did you have to go back and sort of redo the whole thing? Because now, this just happened.
Thankfully, that did not happen with this one. That has happened in some projects. But thankfully, with this one, that initial image was a good starting point and just went from there.
What's next for you? Are you working on a new one?
Yes, I've got a couple projects in the works. I'm working on a new novel with my agent, and we're excited about it. We'll see what happens.
Are you going to stay in the Appalachians for this?
I do have some story ideas that are set in this region. I also have some story ideas that are in Savannah, Georgia, Lowcountry, just different areas in the South.
Great stuff. Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for talking with
us. Thank you so much.
My guest is Heather Bell Adams. She is the author of Maranatha Road. It is her debut novel, and you can hear her read from the book on September 10th at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro. Then she's going to be at Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville. That's on the 12th. Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh on the 14th. And, of course, we have all of that at our website, stateofthings.org. Coming up tomorrow on the program, what are the responsibilities of a younger generation to right the wrongs of their ancestors? We will talk to one of the descendants of Robert E. Lee. He wrestled with his past for a long, long time, the fourth great nephew of the Confederate general, stepped onto the stage of MTV Music Awards, spoke out against racism, and now that minister is facing a backlash. We will talk with him tomorrow on the State of Things. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon, Ormond, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.